This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. In this hour, we're back here live talking about politics with Matt Bai. He writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine. He wrote about the 2008 presidential campaign and primaries. He's the author of the book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics, a book that touched on a lot of conversation, particularly about the internet and its role in politics. That's a book that was named a New York Times Notable Book for 2007. During the 2008 primaries, he wrote the popular online blog The Primary Argument, which was featured on the New York Times website. Before coming to work for The Times in 2002, he spent 5 years as national correspondent for Newsweek. And this morning, one of the things that we want to talk about is the way that the Obama administration is working to get its agenda through Congress. The guest says that so far, the president and the administration has been pretty successful at doing that, but they now meet a very, very big test, and that is their effort to reform health care. I think there are a lot of people that feel that if that doesn't get done this year, it's not going to get done. We'll talk a little bit about how this conversation is going and invite people who are listening to ask questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455 at any point here. Questions are welcome. We just ask callers to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep things moving along. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Mr. Bai, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And you?
I'm doing very well.
Good.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
I think one of the things that you pointed out in what our interest was caught particularly by an article that you wrote, I guess maybe about a month ago, that was in the magazine about this particular topic. And I think one of the things that you say is that this administration, certainly as far as the effort to do health care reform is concerned, does not want to go the way the Clintons went. And that maybe one of the big mistakes they made was not involving members of Congress in crafting the plan that they presented. Basically, they put this thing together. They said to Congress, they handed it to them and said, okay, here you go. Now pass this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Obama people realized that was a mistake, and they're trying to do things differently. Setting aside just the issue of health care for the moment, has that, in fact, been the approach that they've taken to working with Congress overall?
Yeah, I mean, and I appreciate you reading the magazine, David. There's a couple of different things going on here. One is exactly what you point out, which is that they learned the lessons of the past, right? If there's a problem, particularly for the Clinton administration, which they looked at carefully, but it was true certainly in the Carter, going back as far as the Carter administration, when they also had a Democratic majority in the Congress, and the Clinton presidency, they actually had very similar numbers numerically in the House and Senate to what President Obama has. And even if you look at the Bush presidency, I think the lesson you learn from this last 30 years or so of mostly former governors coming into office and trying to reform the culture of the Capitol is that you can't just run right over Congress. You can't actually hand them your plan, your agenda, just because you went out and won an election and think that they're just going to get it done for you, even when they're part of your own party. It's a separate institution. It's very touchy about its equal status under the Constitution and its own prerogatives. Congressmen and senators, especially in powerful positions, figure they're going to be around a lot longer than you are unless you do something to harm them, as they felt Clinton did. And so you really have to give some sense of ownership to Congress if you want to get something passed, and you have to be willing to compromise, and you really have to be willing to leave the details of a lot of legislation to the committees that pride themselves on coming up with those details. So that's part of the philosophy, and that's part of what you're seeing. But the other piece here is that this is the first time since 1960, and only the second time in American history, where you have two sitting senators elevated to the jobs of president and vice president, certainly the first presidents come from the Senate as well, since John Kennedy being the most important factor there. So both Obama and Biden and the chief of staff, they chose Rahm Emanuel, who comes out of the House. All of them have a very legislative mindset. They understand the culture of the Congress in a way that modern presidents have not. They understand the tensions there between the two branches. They understand the mistrust that's grown up, and they have a mindset that's really focused on that part of Pennsylvania Avenue. So part of their deference to Congress and their involving congressional leaders in the details of the legislation is a genuine deference to those institutions. And their hiring has been remarkably from the top levels of the House and Senate. As no administration we've seen recently. I called it the most Congress-centric administration in memory, and I think it is. I don't think people realize the extent to which they're connected in their White House to key players on the Hill. So the other part of this is just, I think, cultural rather than strategic.
Yeah. Certainly there's been a lot of attention focused on Rahm Emanuel, particularly for his personality, being somebody who is very, very tough, being the point man for getting things through the Congress. What I think is interesting, and you've written some about that, is the role that Joe Biden has played here. And I feel that I haven't perhaps read that much about that. He certainly is making the most of his connections with members of the Senate, forged over a very long career in the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty certain. You know, they claim not to have crunched the numbers, but Joe Biden spent more time in the Senate, not talking about the House and Senate combined necessarily, more time as a United States senator than any previous president or vice president. He spent 29 years in the Senate. So, when he talks about the Senate, he talks about it as with a kind of passion, a kind of love. I mean, he doesn't. It's not dutiful. It's not, oh God, I've finally escaped the place, and here I am where I've always wanted to be. He misses it, and he misses the people there. And so that, you know, that does have a real impact. He calls senators all the time, or pops up on the Senate floor, because as you know, the vice president has an office in the Senate. Actually, has three offices, and one of them is at the Senate. And you know what people tell me on the Hill is that it's not even to say we want you to vote this way or can you get this done. It's, hey, how are you? What's going on? What do you hear? What do you think is happening there? He really just kind of keeps in touch and keeps in the loop. And you know, he's well liked, particularly his relationships, particularly with the older senators, not so much with the younger, particularly since he went home to Delaware every day. And he has a tremendous amount of respect there. And, of course, you know, as a vice president, you always get a certain amount of deference. So I think he is a very important messenger back and forth, kind of plays an ambassadorial role, and he understands the pitfalls. I mean, the scene I really had fun with in the piece is where he stands up and sort of acts out the process. Forgive me, that's my phone beeping, and I'm sorry.
Okay.
He acts out the process of being out on a limb and having the limb sawed off. And what he was illustrating to me at that point was, you know, how Congress often feels that a president asks them to step out on a limb to vote for something or support something, and then either cuts a deal or abandons the priority altogether and just slices off the limb and leaves the lawmaker hanging. And his point was, you know, we're not going to do that to people.
The administration clearly has the numbers, at least, to pass its legislation without any Republican votes. At the same time, you can't really make the argument that you're working in a bipartisan manner if you do that. What is the administration doing, and in fact, do they have any hope, really, of getting any substantial Republican support for what they want to do?
Well, there's a couple different things going on there. I don't mean to make it more complex than it needs to be, but the first part of the premise of your question isn't quite right. They certainly have the votes in the House. There's nobody, there's moderate coalitions of Democrats making noise in the House, but there's not been a serious sense that any Democratic coalition in the House is going to be large enough or resistant enough to stop progressive legislation in the House. So clearly, the House is just a stylistic decision. Do you want to work with Republicans or do you not? That's not true in the Senate, actually, because you have a centrist bloc of mostly Democrats and some Republicans, a couple of Republicans, who actually can make the difference on legislation. I mean, everybody talks about the filibuster-proof majority, the 60. That's all fine and good in theory, but I don't think anyone realizes how difficult it is to get 60 Democrats on the same page so that all of them, whether you're talking about Ben Nelson from Nebraska or the newest Senator Al Franken on the other end of the ideological spectrum or everybody in between, you know, to get all those people to vote and to have somebody, you know, you really need to get to 61 because nobody wants to be the 60th vote on anything because that kills them in their own state, right? Nobody wants to be the decisive vote. So it's very, very hard to actually make that happen in reality, almost impossible. So in order to get a program like health care passed in the Senate, you really do need a centrist bloc to whom that program is acceptable, and that includes largely members of your own party, but also includes a couple of Republicans, like particularly the Maine senators, Snow and Collins are important there, and there's several others. So I do think they have a numerical reality in the Senate they have to deal with. Now, the question, the larger question you're getting at is, okay, but is it enough to just say you could get Snow and Collins or one other senator to come along? Is it bipartisan? Is it bipartisan enough if you've got the two or three Republican votes you might need as part of a centrist coalition? Or do you need 10, 12 Republican votes? Do you want to be able to go out and say that you've got bipartisan legislation? I think the president believes, and I think he's right about this, that as long as he has seen as sincerely trying to get those votes and reaching out across party lines, he's going to be seen as a more bipartisan president, particularly if he's working with governors and if he's talking to groups out in America that Democratic presidents haven't necessarily addressed before. It's probably too much to expect he's going to get large numbers of Republican votes. They've pretty much determined not to give him that. There's, as Bill Clinton learned and Obama has now learned, there's nothing you can do to make an opposition party work with you when they've determined their best strategy is not to. And so I think the bar here for bipartisanship really can't – it's not fair to make that bar. How many votes does he get? The question is his style bipartisan? And at the end of the day, do people feel as if this is a guy who really wants Republican support and is willing to work with them if they're willing to work with him? And I think to this point, the answer is yes.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Matt Bai. He's a journalist who writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine, has been working for the Times Magazine since 2002. Before that, he spent 5 years as national correspondent for Newsweek, has written a lot about recent American politics, wrote about the 2008 presidential campaign and the primaries. He's also the author of the book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, specifically, what sort of things are is the administration doing to try to reach out and build relationships with members of Congress, maybe particularly Republican ones?
Well, they've certainly had more, and this is important, they've certainly had more members of the House and Senate to the White House physically for various events, including many with the president himself, than any administration we can think of in recent memory. It's kind of a cop-out when I say recent memory, but I can't account for what somebody did in the 1930s unless I do an awful lot of research. But I can tell you that in terms of recent administrations, right, in the last 20 or 30 years, nobody's done as much outreach to both parties socially right now and politically as they have. And that really means something. And again, that comes from, I think, Obama and Biden and Emanuel all coming from the Hill and understanding the culture and how much it means to senators and congressmen to be called up to the White House, to spend time there, to have access, to be able to deliver for their constituents. We got tour tickets. We got Easter egg roll tickets, whatever it is. They understand the importance of this stuff. So, I cited the number in my cover, and as you said, it's been about a month, and I can't remember, but it's an extraordinary proportion of senators and congressmen who've already been up to the White House, or I guess it's down to the White House in Washington terms, since they came into office. They also have all these former high-level Senate congressional aides who are just reaching out every day, and mostly on the Democratic side, but also to Republican colleagues trying to, and Rahm Emanuel himself reaching out to a lot of his former Republican colleagues, Ray LaHood, the Transportation Secretary, a Republican, constantly trying to build some of those bridges and really concentrating on the Republicans they think they can get. They're not wasting a lot of time. You get a lot of grumbling from leadership. They're not wasting a lot of time with the Republican leadership in the House, particularly. They know they're not going to bang their head against a wall. I think they've made a determination that there's a certain segment of Republicans who generally vote with the party, but who they can hope to get support from on a variety of issues, and those are the people they're really targeting for relationships. And I think it's too early to measure the benefit of that stuff, because you can talk about a vote here, a vote there, and the tougher votes are coming up. But I think those relationships can be built over time. You can build a relationship with a congressman or senator, and I think Obama knows this very well, and not get that vote 3-4 times, but then when you really need it on something that you agree with that person on, you might get it. Forgive me, David. That's my my 1.5-year-old daughter screaming while she eats, if you can hear her on the radio.
That's fine.
The luxuries of magazine writing and being at home. So I think it's too early. It's too early. Too cynical. As many of my colleagues do, to sort of just write it off and say, well, clearly they're not getting Republican support. You don't know that until there's a vote you really need and somebody you've been talking to for years who thinks that, you know, this time around I've come to trust you and I can give you my support. We've seen that in previous administrations. I think Ronald Reagan's is a real example of somebody who kept talking with his opponents, kept meeting with his opponents, even when they bludgeoned him in public. And when it mattered, he got a lot of key votes, and he won a lot of begrudging friendship from people and help from people who didn't agree with him.
Yeah. I think you touched on something that's interesting. I think certainly, even though there might have been a little bit of erosion of the popularity of Mr. Obama when he went from the point of being the candidate and then the president-elect to actually trying to do stuff, he still enjoys a lot of support. He's an attractive and charismatic guy. And I guess you can't really underestimate just how important it is, even for a member of Congress who might consider himself or herself a Washington insider, the importance of actually being able to spend time with the president, to be seen with the president, to go to the White House. That's a very important kind of thing.
It's huge. Everybody wants to say, particularly in their home district or state, I was talking to the president, and he's a journalist too. I mean, turn on CNN. I don't do that stuff. But if you turn it on, you know, you'll see my colleagues. Well, the president told me or whatnot, or the president's chief of staff told me. I mean, this is very currency in Washington. And like I said, those tickets, you know, White House tour tickets, Easter egg rolls, this kind of stuff. I mean, to be able, to go to a dinner and be able to talk about that, or even, you know, you have an issue that your constituency cares about, you're not going to get the president on your side, but you're a Democrat, let's say, to be able to say, you know, I met with the president and made my case. That shows something to your constituents that matters. And the White House understands that they need to give people a certain amount of that cover. If they want to get help from people. And he is still a very popular president, I should point out. I mean, he is historically popular. I mean, what he's lost among some Republicans maybe who gave him some latitude early on, but he's held his liberal support to this point, which I think is a major issue for him, and he's held a lot of independent support. And look, this is a guy, you know, you would like to be, particularly if you're a Democrat, but even if you're a moderate Republican, this is a guy who you'd like to have some public relationship with.
We have a couple of callers here. We'd invite others, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll start out here with Oswego, line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, this is interesting because I'm kind of a skeptic when it comes to politics. I think a lot of these people are bought and paid for, especially when it comes to the celebrity kind of people and being involved. I know everybody... And you read about this in the paper a lot. All these celebrities now, Hollywood wants to go to the White House and hobnob with the Obamas, you know. And I'm a Republican, or was a Republican. I'm a independent now. But, you know, I look at this now. I wonder, really, how many people out there are buying the president's vote and buying his policies? And I really have a hard time understanding where some of this stuff is being said on the, you know, especially following the girls. I mean, it seems like, you know, leave the family sessions out of it and let, you know, the families be private. Because I know when you're a president, it's hard to, you know, I'm sure if you're a kid, you're scrutinized with the Secret Service constantly, so they have no privacy. But, you know, as far as Obama's concerned, it just, some of the stuff that he, I want to say, people that are involved with him kind of make me skeptical about what's going on in there. And, you know, the money, I'm sure there's gobs of money floating around there. But what I concern myself is, and I was wondering your opinion, how much does somebody on the outside influence what Obama says? I mean, is it friendship? Is it, you know, like the Hollywood elite? Because I can, again, it goes back to being concerned as a public. It needs to be for the general public and not for somebody, you know, some individuals.
All right. Well, can you take some shot at that?
Yeah, I can only give you my my opinion on this. Obviously, as a fellow independent, it's you could say a lot of things about this president and how they're conducting their presidency, and not all of it kind, because it never all would be. But I don't think there's either a perception or a reason to believe that this is a president who's tied up with big money or who's being bought. Fair is fair. This is a guy who ran without establishment money, with some very strict rules about lobbyists in his campaign, who has shut out lobbyists from White House jobs, although they've issued some exceptions, but the exceptions are really pretty reasonable. It's the rule that was probably a little draconian. You constantly hear lobbyists here in Washington or people who've lobbied at some point in their career in his own party grumbling that, you know, they can't get any help with the White House, that they're barred from jobs or barred from going in for meetings. So I don't, you know, Congress is another story. I mean, whatever's happening in the Senate, certainly you could talk about the influence of money there, but I don't think anyone believes that this president isn't essentially his own guy, to the point where he's not even really, he doesn't come into office really owing a lot of debts to Democratic constituencies, you know, core interest groups in Washington who didn't support him in the primary. And as far as the Hollywood elite, I know everybody wants to be near him and know the president, but they don't really know him. I mean, he's really in the process of sort of meeting a lot of those people. I mean, he really didn't, you know, he's not a guy who spent a lot of time sort of schmoozing as Bill Clinton did with the sort of glitterati of the liberal set. So, you know, I don't think that's Obama's problem in public perception or in reality. I don't, you know, whatever his weaknesses are, and it may be too much of a willingness to compromise. He may leave himself vulnerable to the left. He may be too willing to try to work with Republicans where they're only looking to smack him around. I mean, he's got some issues. But I don't think, you know, again, in terms of public perception or in terms of reality, I think you'd be hard-pressed to make a case that he's carrying somebody else's water, either in the Democratic constituencies or in corporate America or among the moneyed set. I just don't see that occurring.
Hmm. The other thing that, just quickly, maybe you could say something about the caller mentioned, and I think it's very interesting. It seems to me that the Obama administration has been very skillful at managing the image of the administration, and particularly managing and controlling the image of the family.
Yeah, I mean, they get press relations. They're very good at it. And, you know, you always look better at it when the press likes your guy, which in this case, you know, they basically do. And, by the way, I don't think that's the worst indictment in the world. It's tons of, you know, reams of paper have been wasted on this. But, you know, to my mind, if an administration is behaving with respect toward the media and is, you know, basically conducting itself in a straightforward way, answering questions, and if and tackling issues, substantive issues, I think that's, you know, I think it's fair that president's going to get a pretty fair shake in the media. I think that's to be expected. And conversely, presidents who don't work well with the media, who show a certain contempt, and who play kind of political gamesmanship over the substance of issues, I think generally are going to get a worse shake in the media, and I think that's fair too. You know, the thing with the family and the private life is a little tricky, because, you know, you're always going to have people grumbling that, you know, why is the media writing about the kids and, you know, the girls, and that should be off limits, and, you know, privacy and blah. But at the same time, this is a White House that releases photos, right, of the children's first day of school. That, you know, has them in the public for a fair amount of time, you know, lets people snap photos of them playing or whatever. I mean, I think there's a sense that they're able to use it to their advantage, and then when it's not to their advantage, of course, they'll complain that their privacy is being violated. But I think they've been very, very skillful at you know, reinforcing the idea that he's a youthful president, that he's family-oriented, that everyone believes he's kind of a parent, a father, and a husband, you know, just like you. I think that's something they really want to get across to the American public, and they certainly use the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, midpoint here in this conversation, again, let me just tell you real quickly that our guest is Matt Bai. He writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine. He covered the 2008 presidential campaign and primaries. He has written a book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Was named a New York Times Notable Book for 2007. Before joining the Times Magazine in 2002, he spent 5 years as national correspondent for Newsweek. And we're talking here this morning about Washington politics, about the administration and its effort to work with Congress and get its agenda through. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next is Effingham, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you, Dave. Maybe your guest can talk about he culture. He, you know, that's the dominant and has been for some thousands of years. He, it is his. Even what people try to perceive as God is he. And the he culture that is driving humanity into the ground, And your guest is describing now a he culture of politics, which has been all along. And how are we going to circumvent that and look at this condition of the world today that we live in, that is constant war and death and the neglect of people in general, and especially women? How is it that can change? I mean, your guest is commenting on the he culture that is exasperating any and all things that make sense. A bunch of, 500 people in Congress, mostly men, who make all the decisions, who start all the wars, who play into the capitalist paradigm of arming and coexisting with that stuff. I mean, hopefully you can make some comment on that and how it can change women, you know, who are still a majority of the world population. Now, I'm thinking of the ladies in Kenya, and there's another little African country, I think, Liberia, or one of those, that had come forward and renounced sex with men, and that they would reveal their bodies and stand naked in protest of male domination and the hurt that they cause to the whole world. And the males there in, I think it was Liberia, said, we'll let you be president now when they elected a lady, but we'll get it back in 5 years. Well, is that progress? No. We're running it into the ground. And sorry, I went on.
Well, okay, let's get, I don't know if that's something that's a little beyond what we're talking about here, but if you want to say something about that, go ahead.
I'm kind of amazed at how much your caller is totally unrelated, but how much he sounds like Arlen Specter on the phone. I mean, I realize that's not something Arlen Specter would ever say, but it's a remarkable resemblance in voice and cadence. That's Ellen Greenleaf Johnson, the president of Liberia, he's referring to. I have no idea about the protests in the streets or whatnot. I have been to Liberia. I guess, to whatever extent we all reinforce certain cultures, and I get the complaint. I think it is changing. I mean, if the essential question here is, you know, when do women get their due in politics, I think that is changing. I think I think politics generally lags social change. It does not create social change. That's a wide misconception. Politicians don't tend to be trailblazers. They tend to hang on to the old order longer than most everyone else. We had a black president years after two black presidents graced, you know, the TV show 24, and nobody seemed to have a problem with it. 24 just had a woman president, and I think that's indicative of something too. I don't think, for various reasons, Hillary Clinton may not have been the best candidate or the best candidate for the moment to make that to scale that hurdle. But I would be very shocked if we did not have a woman president in the next decade or two, and more from that time forward. We'd see more women in the Senate, more women in the House. It's just politics is slow to change. It's slow to change racially too, and ethnically, and in terms of gender. But I have great faith that it is, in fact, changing to reflect more of the society at large.
When Barack Obama was elected, I'm certain that Democrats in Congress were pleased with the idea of having a Democrat in the White House. At the same time, I would expect some of them would be not quite sure what it would be like to work with him, what he would be like, what his agenda truly would be. What did the Democrats in Congress really think of Mr. Obama, at least right in the beginning?
That's a great question, David. It's still a great question. They don't know the guy. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. They don't know the president. Very few people in Congress know the president. I mean, if you talk to senators, even those who like him, they'll tell you that he never really was there, or he was there for a couple of years. They're very dismissive of the time he spent there, because, you know, he was a senator for a couple of years, during which you're really trying to get your feet under you and figure out where the bathrooms are and what your staff does and all of that. I mean, you don't really get the chance to do very much. You get low-level committee assignments. You know, you're the least senior person. And then, you know, he took off to run for president. So they don't consider him as having really ever served in the Senate, and they spent very little time with him. So, there's not a strong sense of him. It's not as if, well, he came out of the Senate, we know Barack Obama, and here's what he's about. Some of them have warm feelings toward him, and they had nice interactions, but they're still trying to figure out what he believes. I think, in a larger sense, you know, I think the Congress, the party, and to a large extent the country, is still trying to figure out what it is Barack Obama believes. And I say this not as a criticism, not to say he's shiftless or, you know, or shifty or can't be nailed down on things or is oily. I don't think it's that sense at all. I think it's literally the sense of not knowing his heart very well, of having him be new in public life, a relatively young career. I think this is to his advantage in a lot of cases, because if you talk to liberal Democrats in the House, they'll tell you, we really think he's with us. Barack Obama would be for a liberal renaissance in the country, much like the New Deal, if we could just get these centrist senators to roll over and get industry to back down. And then, you know, if you talk to the centrist members of the Senate, they'll tell you, you know, we think Obama's just like us. He's basically told us he basically has a pragmatic centrist series of instincts about politics. And the question is how he pushes away sort of the left base of his party. So right now, I think it's really worked to his advantage that people see in him what they want to see in him. But I think it's inevitable that over time, members of the House and Senate, members of his own party, and the American voters at large are going to get a much stronger sense of where Barack Obama is politically in his heart and in his views and how strongly he clings to that. My own gut sense, not worth any more than anyone else's. I certainly don't know him well. I know him a little. I know the people around him. I think he is basically a pragmatist. I think he is much more of my generation. I'm 40. He's, 46, 47? I think he's of a generation that's generally less ideological and generally less party-affiliated. I think he's essentially of an era, post-60s era, that doesn't really buy into the more dogmatic pieces of politics. And I think the challenge for him is to keep his left flank happy and invested and sympathetic to what he's trying to do, while at the same time, perhaps moving toward more of the compromises that I think are more in his nature.
Yeah. Well, that seems to me that's going to be a really serious challenge. This was something that I was certainly expecting, that it wouldn't be very long after he took office that liberals would be complaining that he's too conservative. And certainly that you can see, just as one example, some of the reactions from people who were really hardcore supporters of national health to what it is the administration is talking about now.
Yeah, and it's getting dicier now, as you say. I mean, the first couple months, you know, look, I mean, as I said in the cover piece, I mean, I'm not going to suggest that the stimulus bill or the budget vote or the TARP vote, the economic recovery for the banks, you know, the money for them, I'm not going to suggest those were easy votes. The White House had to work hard to get certain margins and to get those things passed as they wanted them. But, you know, at the end of the day, what are you asking for? You're asking for Congress to spend money in their districts. And that's not the heaviest lift in politics, right? No one has ever destroyed themselves politically begging Congress to spend money for their constituents. The real tests are now coming up. I mean, healthcare, which is a gigantic issue, climate change, which is a very tough issue, and don't forget the foreign policy piece of this, because the war in Afghanistan, to which President Obama is very committed, is a very big piece of this too. It's considerably harder, right? If he's not willing, obviously, to go towards single payer health care, which is very popular on the left, it's not clear that, you know, he's probably going to have to get behind and embrace whatever comes out of the Finance Committee. That's going to be the only bipartisan proposal. It may be the only proposal that has a very strong chance of passing the Senate. I don't think that's going to make the left and his party all that thrilled. They're furious over Afghanistan. They were furious over the torture memos, the fact that he wouldn't release all the information, the fact that he's not eliminating military tribunals altogether. This is a real challenge for him, because little by little, I think it's becoming revealed that he is not a traditional dogmatic liberal, and not only because of pragmatism, not only because he needs to get elected or, you know, in a Clintonian way because he's trying to finesse issues, because I just don't think that's where his heart is, and I don't think it was where President Clinton's heart is. And then the question is, are you dealing with people in a straight-up enough way, candidly enough, charmingly enough? Do they feel fairly treated in a way that they're willing to tolerate some disagreement and still be strong supporters? That's a very hard thing to do in politics. It takes a considerable amount of personal skill and effort.
The Republicans, they're in sort of a tough position here in that, well, first of all, they need to stand by their ideology, but also they can take a couple of choices, I suppose. Either they can try to work with the president, they can stand apart, and that gives them the advantage that if things go badly, they have no ownership in what happens. The flip side of that is, if things go okay, they have no ownership in the solution either. Is there some sort of consensus within the GOP, you think, on what sort of strategy they should take toward the president and what he wants to do?
I think you have a certain split in Washington and outside Washington, it seems to me. In Washington, there's a pretty good consensus in the House and Senate. Less so in the Senate, but it's still pretty, I would say it's a pretty strong consensus that you can't work with him on what he wants to do. They don't like what he wants to do. They don't want to empower him. They understand, as a matter of Washington politics, that if you're the party that enabled him to get his agenda done, but a little less than his own party, that doesn't get you much, right? Yeah, we worked with the president. We kind of, sort of, got a compromise, but you know, it's his agenda that he got passed. I mean, you're not getting credit for that. But outside Washington, particularly among Republican governors, there's a feeling that you know the party of no thing, that this idea that all you're doing is obstructing his agenda is really problematic for the party, particularly looking toward another presidential run. And I think looking toward a presidential run, it probably is. But look, I'm in the minority of people that probably believes that despite themselves and despite a very unimpressive cadre of leaders at this point, the Republican Party in Washington has probably done the only thing it can do and probably has taken a pretty smart tactic here toward its rebuilding. I can understand why governors feel that it's not advantageous to run a presidential campaign in 2012 based on the fact that you're a party that stood in the way. But if you look at congressional elections, if your thinking is on the off-year elections that are coming up in 2010, then look, if you're a Republican, an intellectually honest Republican, you believe a couple of things. You believe that government doesn't do things well. Whenever government take something on, it does it poorly, and you believe that high-spending government is irresponsible and that the public doesn't like it. And if you believe those two things, then there's every reason to oppose this president's agenda, because you then have to believe that all the programs and the spending he's passing are not going to achieve what they're supposed to achieve because government doesn't do things well, and that the public is going to get really tired of seeing trillions of dollars go out the door with no way to balance that spending over the short or medium term. And so if you believe that, I think that is your best strategy probably for 2010, is to hope that this thing turns around on you, that, yeah, people are really angry at us now and they love the president, but ultimately this can't work. This just isn't the right way for government to spend money. People aren't going to like it, and it's not going to work, and that's going to put us in good standing come the midterm elections. I think that is a thoroughly intellectually honest position to take, and politically it may be the most pragmatic position to take. I have no idea whether it works, but I can't think of a way that you'd put yourself in a better position for the midterms coming up.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Matt Bai. He writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine, wrote a lot about the 2008 presidential campaign and the primaries. He's the author of the book The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. And he's joining us this morning here by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Just for a moment to get back to what the administration is talking about in terms of health care reform, basically what I understand is here is what they're talking about is some plan that would require most employers to offer benefits to the people who work for them or to pay something to the government so that the government can do that, then would create an alternative, some kind of public plan, so that if people have no access any other way to insurance, they can buy into that plan. Mm-hmm. It's something that that point is something that the Republicans in Congress have said no way on that. There's been a lot of conversation about how much this would cost and how many people still would not be insured. At this point, do you have some sort of sense about what's the plan going to be?
Well, I don't think anybody has a very strong sense of it yet, because a lot's going to depend on what the Finance Committee and the Senate does. There's a House plan kind of shaping up. There's a Kennedy-Dodd plan in the Senate, which has been out there and has been retooled now because the analysis of it from the Congressional Budget Office wasn't flattering. But a lot's going to depend on the Finance Committee. I mean, to look at this sort of globally in a way that people can understand, because it is incredibly complex. So the way I would put this is there's two big questions. The first question is substantive, right? It's what does a plan look like? And the real disagreement there, as you point out, is over this public plan. Should there be a public option for people to get insurance that would compete with private insurers. Everything else, I think they can pretty much hash out. This is a subject of debate within the Democratic caucus in the Senate, and then particularly with Republicans who just won't vote for it. It's a non-starter. The president has said he wants a public plan. Liberals want a public plan. A lot of liberals see it as a gateway to a larger federal role in health care and as a critical piece of ensuring that people can get affordable health care. There are some compromise options being floated, and what everyone is waiting to see is what the Finance Committee, which is the only bipartisan proposal that's going to come out. That's why it's so important. Max Baucus, the Democrat, is working with Chuck Grassley, the Republican. They're going to have some kind of bipartisan proposal in the next week or two, I would guess. So everyone's waiting for that because that's the one that's going to have the best chance of passing. And the question is that going to have a public option or not? And I don't know the answer, and I don't think anybody outside of it knows the answer. My guess would be no if it's going to be a bipartisan option, but there may be some compromise measure in there. The second question is how you pay for it. And this is a real big issue because we're talking about the latest figure on the Kennedy Dodd plan would be, after they retooled it, was something like $650 billion, but it would cover significantly fewer people. Covering more of the uninsured gets you to $1 trillion and over and as high as $1.5 trillion. So the question is, how many people are you going to cover and how are you going to pay for it? There's all kinds of proposals out there. The Finance Committee is likely to, to adapt a measure that would limit the tax benefits you get as an employee. So if you're working for NPR and you get benefits, a benefit plan, and that benefit plan is worth a certain amount or more, you're going to be taxed on it as income. That's politically explosive. You're really saying to a lot of Americans, this is a new tax for you to subsidize health care for other people. But I think that's likely to be one of the options. There's some new revenue areas you can get, like sin taxes. There's this payer placing that you describe, which I think is also probably likely, where employers are either going to have to offer insurance. Employers of a certain amount of employees, a certain size company, is either going to have to offer insurance or pay some fee toward the subsidizing of insurance for other people. So, all this stuff is still to be worked out. But those are the two basic things to watch for. The answers we're looking for here are public option or not, and how exactly do you propose to pay for all this beyond the savings, this amorphous idea that there will be savings and efficiencies in the system that are very, very hard to quantify or rely on.
Yeah. In this piece that we've talked about a little bit that you wrote for the magazine, you wrote that going into this, the administration had expected to be working closely with two guys in the Senate, Tom Daschle and Ted Kennedy. Unfortunately, Senator Daschle had some tax issues, and Senator Kennedy has been dealing with serious illness. So it turns out that somebody who was not that well-known has emerged here as being quite important, and you've mentioned him. That's Max Baucus from Montana. What has his role been?
He's a fascinating figure in all this. I mean, if you care about politics like I do and you follow it, he's a fascinating guy. Baucus is, I think, the fifth most senior member of the Senate. I might be off by one or two, but he's been there a long time. And of the group who were most senior, perhaps, maybe you could count Senator Inouye in Hawaii this way too, although at one time he was much more public front and center. But, Baucus of that group, he's really been one of the lowest profile. And people don't hear a lot about him, but he's very powerful as chairman of the Senate committee. Powerful enough, in fact, that his former chief of staff and confidant is now a deputy White House chief of staff, partly because he had joined the campaign help, but partly because they wanted that line in. The White House wanted to have a direct line to Senator Baucus because he is that important. A lot of the lobbying efforts are focused on Senator Baucus. A lot of the lobbyists who've been hired have ties to Senator Baucus, and he has ties to some industry groups. But he's a very important player here. And the reason, the way he's changed this process, the reason that Baucus is so critically important is that he's the guy in power in the Democratic Party on this issue who is demanding a bipartisan plan. In other words, everybody else is willing to shove this down the Republicans' throats. They can do it by a process called reconciliation, which is sort of a drastic measure that enables you to suspend normal rules by going back and just using a simple majority vote. Just about every other powerful Democrat on this issue in the committees in the House and Senate are willing to sort of give Republicans a shot and then brush them aside and just do it. Baucus is the guy who is insisting on a bill that has bipartisan support, is willing to make compromises that others won't make, and is still at the table with Grassley and other Republicans now after months and months of this, and is close apparently to having a plan. Because he just thinks it's unsustainable to pass this as a purely Democratic program. There are some structural problems with doing it as a reconciliation vote. It has to be renewed in 10 years. It's susceptible to a lot of challenges while you're voting on it. So he just feels that that's not going to work. And that is having a critical impact on the process, because if you do end up getting a plan with some bipartisan support, a compromise plan that's going to make some on the left angry but is going to really pass landmark legislation in a permanent way, I think you're going to have to look at Max Baucus as having been the primary driver in doing that. And conversely, if this thing fails and goes off the rails in Congress because there aren't enough centrist Democrats who will vote for a bill that doesn't have bipartisan support, because the bill that ultimately comes forward is not a bipartisan bill, then that's going to have to be attributed in large part to Senator Baucus's activity as well.
This, I'm sure, will occupy people in Washington now for some time, maybe for the rest of the session. Certainly, I would think that there'd be an intense period of activity here between the point where they're now headed back and they take their August recess. Next week will be the beginnings of hearings for the Judge Sotomayor, who's been nominated to the Supreme Court, which I'm sure will occupy a lot of people's attention there in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
What else is there? Are there any other big things the administration hopes to try to do between now and the end of the year? Or
well,
these two
like
things enough?
I mean, yeah, you would think that would be enough. And then you got, don't forget, you got Afghanistan. Today he's got you've got Iraq. Today he's got the announcement of an arms agreement, the beginnings of an arms agreement with Russia. So there are, and then don't forget climate change. This is a huge thing, which they've taken on. The House is sending out a bill that would be, I think, the most sweeping energy legislation at least in a half century, maybe in the history of the Congress. The White House seems to be squarely behind that and is going to take that to the Senate. Then you have to consider, the ongoing effort to overhaul the financial regulatory system, which appears to be a priority. Obviously, the economy and the and jobs and spending that stimulus money. There could be a second stimulus in the offing at some point. So this is a White House that does not have one clear priority for the year, for its first year. I mean, healthcare, I think if you had to pick one that was defining, I would certainly pick healthcare, and I did, and that's why I wrote about it. But you can't dismiss this other stuff. They're playing on several fronts at once, and they are effectively rejecting the conventional wisdom that says you have to tell a story one vote at a time, right? One issue at a time. And that's something I'm actually just starting to write a column about today, as you and I speak, because I think it's an interesting shift in what we generally think of as the accepted way to pursue a presidency.
I'm sure that the danger there is that your efforts get fragmented if you try to go into many different directions at once.
I think that's right. Yeah, the danger is you don't build constituency for any of your particular issues, and I think you see this in the polling. And I'm sure this is a number that bothers them. If I were them, I think it would be the most ominous number coming back from myriad polls, which is that he retains, the president, the leader of the he culture, as our caller said, retains a very, very high level of popularity for a president. But on no specific issue does he get the same level of support. I mean, his support for every proposal lags his personal support, and I think that is probably a result of the fragmentation that you mentioned. It is a result of people not being hammered, educated, or brought along on any one issue, but having to deal with so many at once that it's very, very hard to focus. It's hard to win people over. And at the end of the day, people. I mean, look, when Jimmy Carter's presidency completely unraveled, I'm not saying Obama's Carter because I don't think he is, but when Jimmy Carter's presidency completely unraveled, his personal approval ratings in terms of honesty and candor and likability were exceptionally high. Nobody decided Jimmy Carter was a bad guy. They just decided they didn't like his policies very much and that he wasn't a very good leader. And so it has to concern you, I think, if you're the Obama White House, that personal popularity doesn't necessarily translate into strong public will for your policies. And when people in Congress see that, they may determine that they can oppose your policies without being so concerned that they'll be overwhelmed by your popularity.
That's an interesting dilemma, I guess. I don't know how it is you approach that. Clearly, if you weren't popular, you would have also a difficult time getting your agenda advanced.
Yeah, that's right. I think the traditional model here is to use your popularity, otherwise known as political capital, right? To use it to get one thing done. Use it to hammer at one thing first, one or two big things, to make the public understand it, to tell a story, to persuade voters, cash it in, right? Try and get something done, and then build off that. So the traditional model would be, I've got a, you know, a 65% approval rating or a 60% approval rating. I want to get health care done. And I'm going to go out and I'm going to talk about health care every day, and I'm only going to talk about health care. I'm going to tell the same story over and over, and I'm going to win it. And when I win it, I'm going to be even more popular, and then I'll deal with the next thing. Their model seems to be that you can use that cachet essentially to pass a broad sense of your agenda, right? To use it to sort of build compromises on a broad number of issues at once, and convince people that you've done the right thing to find some compromise.
Well, that other strategy, I recall the last president, when he was going into his second term, holding a press conference and standing there in front of the reporters and saying, virtually saying, I won. I have political capital. I intend to spend it. And then he said the way that he was going to spend it is Social Security reform. Well, we know where that went. No place.
True, but there were a couple things about that. I mean, one, that was a little bit delusional because again, as he did in the first, Bush was never really elected by anything like the margin Barack Obama got. Right? I mean, he barely. We all know the story of Florida in 2000, and in 2004 he wins by this tiny margin in Ohio. So the political capital they claimed to have, which was apparently based on the fact that he was taking the oath of office, wasn't reflected in the voting numbers and wasn't reflected in the polling. So you have to actually have the capital, first of all, which I don't think they did. And then the way they went about Social Security really goes back to where we started this conversation, where they went to the Hill. In fact, it's Max Baucus we were just talking about. They went to Baucus, who'd worked with the White House quite a bit, and they said, we've got this plan. We're going to do this Social Security thing. And Baucus said, that's privatization. I can't go for that, but I'm willing to work with you on shoring up Social Security. Let's sit down. Let's have a compromise. The White House said, we're not compromising on this. This is our plan. And then they went to Montana and campaigned for it in his backyard. So they came in, you know, very much with this idea that we're going to tell Congress how this gets done and they're going to do it because we've got the Republicans in the House and Senate to pass it. And it was a classically bad approach to Congress, and it backfired.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Matt Bai, writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine. You might want to look at his book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Thanks very much.
Anytime. I'm glad to do it. Thanks, David.